Chapter 6.
Olhado.
Their only intercourse with other tribes seems to be warfare. When they tell stories to each other, usually during rainy weather, it almost always deals with battles and heroes. The ending is always death for heroes and cowards alike. If the stories are any guideline, piggies don't expect to live through war, and they never, ever give the slightest hint of interest in the enemy females, either for rape, murder, or slavery, the traditional human treatment of the wives of fallen soldiers. Does this mean that there is no genetic exchange between tribes? Not at all. The genetic exchanges may be conducted by the females, who may have some system of trading genetic favors. Given the apparent utter subservience of the males to the females in piggy society, this could easily be going on without the males having any idea, or it might cause them such shame that they just won't tell us about it. What they want to tell us about is battle. A typical description. From my daughter Wanda's notes of 2/21 last year, during a session of storytelling inside the log house. Piggy, speaking Stark. He killed three of the brothers without taking a wound. I have never seen such a strong and fearless warrior. Blood was high on his arms, and the stick in his hand was splintered and covered with the brains of my brothers. He knew he was honorable, even though the rest of the battle went against his feeble tribe. Dei Yonra, Eulie Dei, I gave honor. I gave it to him. Other piggies click their tongues and speak. Piggy, I hooked him to the ground. He was powerful in his struggles until I showed him the grass in my hand. Then he opened his mouth and hummed the strange songs of the far country. Nun se sera pau no mau da gente. He will never be a stick in our hands. At this point, they joined in singing a song in the wives' language, one of the longest passages yet heard. Note that this is a common pattern among them, to speak primarily in Stark, then switch into Portuguese at the moment of climax and conclusion. On reflection, we have realized that we do the same thing, falling into our native Portuguese at the most emotional moments. This account of battle may not seem so unusual until you hear enough stories to realize that they always end with the hero's death. Apparently they have no taste for light comedy. Liberdade Figueira de Medici, report on intertribal patterns of Lusitanian aborigines in cross-cultural transactions, 1964, 12, 40.
There wasn't much to do during interstellar flight. Once the course was charted and the ship had made the park shift, the only task was to calculate how near to light speed the ship was traveling. The shipboard computer figured the exact velocity and then determined how long, in subjective time, the voyage should continue before making the park shift back to a manageable sublight speed. Like a stopwatch, thought Ender. Click it on, click it off, and the race is over. The ship's computers were bright enough to help him get the hang of the switch from his fluent Spanish to Portuguese. It was easy enough to speak, but so many consonants were left out that understanding it was hard. Speaking Portuguese with the slow-witted ship's computer became maddening after an hour or two each day. On every other voyage, Val had been there. Not that they had always talked. Val and Ender knew each other so well that there was often nothing to say. But without her there, Ender grew impatient with his own thoughts. They never came to a point because there was no one to tell them to. Even the Hive Queen was no help. Her thoughts were instantaneous, bound not to synapses but to phylotes that were untouched by the relativistic effects of light speed. She passed 16 hours for every minute of Ender's time. The differential was too great for him to receive any kind of communication from her. If she were not in a cocoon, she would have thousands of individual buggers, each doing its own task and passing to her vast memory its experiences. But now all she had were her memories. And in his 8 days of captivity, Ender began to understand her eagerness to be delivered. By the time the 8 days passed, He was doing fairly well at speaking Portuguese directly instead of translating from Spanish whenever he wanted to say anything. He was also desperate for human company. He would have been glad to discuss religion with a Calvinist, just to have somebody smarter than the ship's computer to talk to. The starship performed the park shift. In an immeasurable moment, its velocity changed relative to the rest of the universe. Or, rather, the theory had it, that in fact, the velocity of the rest of the universe changed while the starship remained truly motionless. No one could be sure because there was nowhere to stand to observe the phenomenon. It was anybody's guess, since nobody understood why philotic effects worked anyway. The Ansible had been developed half by accident, and along with it, the Park instantaneity principle. It may not be comprehensible, but it worked. The windows of the starship instantly filled with stars, as light became visible again in all directions. Someday, a scientist would discover why the Park shift took almost no energy. Somewhere, Ender was certain, a terrible price was being paid for human starflight. He had dreamed once of a star winking out every time a starship made the Park shift. Jane assured him that it wasn't so, but he knew that most stars were invisible to us. A trillion of them could disappear and we'd not know it. For thousands of years, we would continue to see the photons that had already been launched before the star disappeared. By the time we could see the galaxy go blank, it would be far too late to amend our course. "Sitting there in paranoid fantasy," said Jane. "You can't read minds," said Ender. "You always get morose and speculate about the destruction of the universe whenever you come out of starflight. It's your peculiar manifestation of motion sickness. Have you alerted Lusitanian authorities that I'm coming? It's a very small colony. There's no landing authority because hardly anybody goes there. There's an orbiting shuttle that automatically takes people up and down to a laughable little shuttleport. No clearance from immigration. You're a speaker. They can't turn you away. Besides, immigration consists of the governor, who is also the mayor, since the city and the colony are identical. Her name is Faria Lima Maria Duboski, called Bosquinha. And she sends you greetings and wishes you would go away, since they've got trouble enough without a prophet of agnosticism going around annoying good Catholics. She said that? Actually, not to you. Bishop Peregrino said it to her, and she agreed. But it's her job to agree. If you tell her that Catholics are all idolatrous, superstitious fools, she'll probably sigh and say, 'I hope you can keep those opinions to yourself.' You're stalling," said Ender. "What is it you think I don't want to hear?" Novinia canceled her call for a speaker 5 days after she sent it. Of course, the Starways code said that once Ender had begun his voyage in response to her call, the call could not legally be canceled. Still, it changed everything. Because instead of eagerly awaiting his arrival for 22 years, she would be dreading it, resenting him for coming when she had changed her mind. He had expected to be received by her as a welcome friend. Now she would be even more hostile than the Catholic establishment. "Anything to simplify my work," he said. "Well, it's not all bad, Andrew. You see, in the intervening years, a couple of other people have called for a speaker, and they haven't canceled." "Who?" "By the most fascinating coincidence, they are Novinia's son Miro and Novinia's daughter Ella. They couldn't possibly have known Pippo. Why would they call me to speak his death?" "Oh no, not Pippo's death. Ella called for a speaker only 6 weeks ago to speak the death of her father, Novinia's husband, Marcos Maria Ribeira, called Marcão. He keeled over in a bar, not from alcohol. He had a disease. He died of terminal rot. I worry about you, Jane. Consumed with compassion the way you are. Compassion is what you're good at. I'm better at complex searches through organized data structures. And the boy, what's his name? Miro. He called for a speaker 4 years ago for the death of Pippo's son, Libo. Libo couldn't be older than 40. He was helped along to an early death. He was Xenologer, you see, or Xenador, as they say in Portuguese. The piggies, exactly like his father's death. The organs placed exactly the same. 3 piggies have been executed the same way while you were en route, though farther from the gate. But they plant trees in the middle of the piggy corpses, and no such honor for the dead humans. Both Xenologers murdered by the piggies, a generation apart. What has the Starways Council decided?" "It's very tricky. They keep vacillating. They haven't certified either of Lebo's apprentices as a knowledger. One is Lebo's daughter, Wanda, and the other is Miro, the one who called for a speaker. Do they maintain contact with the piggies? Officially, no. There's some controversy about this. After Lebo died, the council forbade contact more frequently than once a month, but Lebo's daughter categorically refused to obey the order. And they didn't remove her? The majority for cutting back on contact with the piggies was paper thin. There was no majority for censuring her. At the same time, they worry that Miro and Wanda are so young. 2 years ago, a party of scientists was dispatched from Calicut. They should be here to take over supervision of piggy affairs in only 33 more years. Do they have any idea this time why the piggies killed the Xenologer? None at all. But that's why you're here, isn't it? The answer would have been easy, except that the Hive Queen nudged him gently in the back of his mind. Ender could feel her like wind through the leaves of a tree. A rustling, a gentle movement, and sunlight. Yes, he was here to speak for the dead, but he was also here to bring the dead back to life.
This is a good place.
The Hive Queen was making the enormous effort to speak to him during near light-speed flight.
There's a mind here, much clearer than any human mind we've known.
The piggies? They think the way you do?
It knows of the piggies. A little time. It's afraid of us.
The Hive Queen withdrew, and Ender was left to ponder the thought that with Lusitania he may have bitten off more than he could chew.
Bishop Peregrino delivered the homily himself. That was always a bad sign. Never an exciting speaker, he had become so convoluted and parenthetical that half the time Ella couldn't even understand what he was talking about. King pretended he could understand, of course, because as far as he was concerned, the bishop could do no wrong. But little Grego made no attempt to seem interested, even when Sister Esquisimiento was roving the aisle with her needle-sharp nails in cruel grip. Grego fearlessly performed whatever mischief entered his head. Today he was prying the rivets out of the back of the plastic bench in front of them. It bothered Ella how strong he was. A 6-year-old shouldn't be able to work a screwdriver under the lip of a heat-sealed rivet. Ella wasn't sure she could do it. If Father were here, of course, his long arm would snake out and gently, oh so gently, take the screwdriver out of Grego's hand. He would whisper, "Where did you get this?" And Grego would look at him with wide and innocent eyes. Later, when the family got home from Mass, Father would rage at Miro for leaving tools around, calling him terrible names and blaming him for all the troubles of the family. Miro would bear it in silence. Ella would busy herself with preparation for the evening meal. King would sit uselessly in the corner, massaging the rosary and murmuring his useless little prayers. Oyado was the lucky one, with his electronic eyes. He simply turned them off, or played back some favorite scene from the past and paid no attention. Quara went off and cowered in the corner. And little Grego stood there triumphantly, his hand clutching Father's pant leg, watching as the blame for everything he did was poured out on Miro's head. Ella shuddered as the scene played itself out in her memory. If it had ended there, it would have been bearable. But then Miro would leave, and they would eat, and then... Sister Esquismento's spidery fingers leapt out. Her fingernails dug into Grego's arm. Instantly, Grego dropped the screwdriver. Of course, it was supposed to clatter on the floor, but Sister Esquismento was no fool. She bent quickly and caught it in her other hand. Grego grinned. Her face was only inches from his knee. Ella saw what he had in mind, reached out to try to stop him, but too late. He brought his knee up sharply into Sister Esquisimento's mouth. She gasped from the pain and let go of Grego's arm. He snatched the screwdriver out of her slackened hand. Holding a hand to her bleeding mouth, she fled down the aisle. Grego resumed his demolition work. "Father is dead," Ella reminded herself. The word sounded like music in her mind. "Father is dead, but he's still here because he left his monstrous little legacy behind. The poison he put in us all is still ripening, and eventually it will kill us all. When he died, His liver was only 2 inches long, and his spleen could not be found. Strange fatty organs had grown in their places. There was no name for the disease. His body had gone insane, forgotten the blueprint by which human beings were built. Even now, the disease still lives on in his children. Not in our bodies, but in our souls. We exist where normal human children are expected to be, or even shaped the same. But each of us in our own way has been replaced by an imitation child, shaped out of a twisted, fetid, lipidous goiter that grew out of father's soul. Maybe it would be different if mother tried to make it better, but she cared about nothing but microscopes and genetically enhanced cereals, or whatever she was working on now. So-called speaker for the dead. But there is only one who can speak for the dead, and that is Sagrado Cristo. Bishop Peregrino's words caught her attention. What was he saying about a speaker for the dead? He couldn't possibly know she had called for one. The law requires us to treat him with courtesy, but not with belief. The truth is not to be found in the speculations and hypotheses of unspiritual men, but in the teachings and traditions of Mother Church. So when he walks among you, give him your smiles, but hold back your hearts. Why was he giving this warning? The nearest planet was Trondheim, 22 light-years away, and it wasn't likely there'd be a speaker there. It would be decades till a speaker arrived, if one came at all. She leaned over Quara to ask Keen. He would have been listening. "What's this about a speaker for the dead?" she whispered. "If you'd listen, you'd know for yourself. If you don't tell me, I'll deviate your septum." Keen smirked to show her he wasn't afraid of her threats. But since, in fact, he was afraid of her, he then told her. "Some faithless wretch apparently requested a speaker back when the first Sinologer died, and he arrives this afternoon. He's already on the shuttle, and the mayor is on her way out to meet him when he lands." She hadn't bargained for this. The computer hadn't told her a speaker was already on the way. He was supposed to come years from now to speak the truth about the monstrosity called Father, who had finally blessed his family by dropping dead. The truth would come like light to illuminate and purify their past. But Father was too recently dead for him to be spoken now. His tentacles still reached out from the grave and sucked at their hearts. The homily ended, and eventually so did the Mass. She held tightly to Grego's hand, trying to keep him from snatching someone's book or bag as they threaded through the crowd. King was good for something, at least. He carried Quara, who always froze up when she was supposed to make her way among strangers. Ollado switched his eyes back on and took care of himself, winking metallically at whatever 15-year-old semi-virgin he was hoping to horrify today. Ella genuflected at the statues of Os Venerados, her long-dead, half-sainted grandparents. "Aren't you proud to have such lovely grandchildren as us?" Grego was smirking. Sure enough, he had a baby's shoe in his hand. Ella silently prayed that the infant had come out of the encounter unbloodied. She took the shoe from Grego and laid it on the little altar where candles burned in perpetual witness of the miracle of the Descolada. Whoever owned the shoe, they'd find it there.
Mayor Bosquinha was cheerful enough as the car skimmed over the grassland between the shuttleport and the settlement of Milagre. She pointed out herds of semi-domestic cabra, a native species that provided fibers for cloth, but whose meat was nutritionally useless to human beings. "Do the piggies eat them?" asked Ender. She raised an eyebrow. "We don't know much about the piggies. We know they live in the forest. Do they ever come out on the plain?" She shrugged. "That's for the Framlings to decide." Ender was startled for a moment to hear her use that word. But, of course, Demosthenes' latest book had been published 22 years ago and distributed through the 100 worlds by Ansible. Utlanning, Framling, Raman, Varelsa. The terms were part of Stark now, and probably did not even seem particularly novel to Bosquinha. It was her lack of curiosity about the piggies that left him feeling uncomfortable. The people of Lusitania couldn't possibly be unconcerned about the piggies. They were the reason for the high, impassable fence that none but the Xenadors could cross. No, she wasn't incurious. She was avoiding the subject. Whether it was because the murderous piggies were a painful subject or because she didn't trust the speaker for the dead, he couldn't guess. They crested a hill and she stopped the car. Gently it settled onto its skids. Below them, a broad river wound its way among grassy hills. Beyond the river, the farther hills were completely covered with forest. Along the far bank of the river, brick and plaster houses with tile roofs made a picturesque town. Farmhouses perched on the near bank, their long, narrow fields reaching toward the hill where Ender and Bosquinha sat. "Milagre," said Bosquinha. "On the highest hill, the cathedral. Bishop Peregrino has asked the people to be polite and helpful to you." From her tone, Ender gathered that he had also let them know that he was a dangerous agent of agnosticism. "Until God strikes me dead," he asked. Bosquinha smiled. "God is setting an example of Christian tolerance, and we expect everyone in town will follow. Do they know who called me?" "Whoever called you has been discreet." "You're the governor, besides being mayor. You have some privileges of information. I know that your original call was canceled, but too late. I also know that two others have requested speakers in recent years. But you must realize that most people are content to receive their doctrine and their consolation from the priests. They'll be relieved to know that I don't deal in doctrine or consolation. Your kind offer to let us have your cargo of skrika will make you popular enough in the bars, and you can be sure you'll see plenty of vain women wearing the pelts in the months to come. It's coming on to autumn. I happened to acquire the skrika with the starship. It was of no use to me, and I don't expect any special gratitude for it." He looked at the rough, furry-looking grass around him. "This grass, it's native?" "And useless. We can't even use it for thatch. If you cut it, it crumbles, and then dissolves into dust in the next rain. But down there, in the fields, the most common crop is a special breed of amaranth that our xenobiologist developed for us. Rice and wheat were feeble and undependable crops here, but the amaranth is so hardy that we have to use herbicides around the fields to keep it from spreading. Why? This is a quarantined world, Speaker. The amaranth is so well suited to this environment that it would soon choke out the native grasses. The idea is not to terraform Lusitania. The idea is to have as little impact on this world as possible." "That must be hard on the people." "Within our enclave, Speaker, we are free and our lives are full. And outside the fence, no one wants to go there anyway." The tone of her voice was heavy with concealed emotion. Ender knew then that the fear of the piggies ran deep. "Speaker, I know you're thinking that we're afraid of the piggies, and perhaps some of us are. But the feeling most of us have most of the time isn't fear at all. It's hatred. Loathing. You've never seen them. You must know of the two Xenadors who were killed. I suspect you were originally called to speak the death of Pipo. But both of them, Pipo and Libo alike, were beloved here, especially Libo. He was a kind and generous man, and the grief at his death was widespread and genuine. It is hard to conceive of how the piggies could do to him what they did. Dom Cristão, the abbot of the Fios da Menchit de Cristo, he says they must lack the moral sense. He says this may mean that they are beasts, or it may mean that they are unfallen, having not yet eaten of the fruit of the forbidden tree." She smiled tightly. "But that's theology, and so it means nothing to you." He did not answer. He was used to the way religious people assumed that their sacred stories must sound absurd to unbelievers. But Ender did not consider himself an unbeliever, and he had a keen sense of the sacredness of many tales. But he could not explain this to Bosquinha. She would have to change her assumptions about him over time. She was suspicious of him, but he believed she could be won. To be a good mayor, she had to be skilled at seeing people for what they are, not for what they seem. He turned the subject. "The Fios da Menchid de Cristo, my Portuguese isn't strong, but does that mean sons of the mind of Christ?" "They're a new order," relatively speaking, formed only 400 years ago under a special dispensation of the Pope.
Oh,
I know the children of the mind of Christ, Mayor. I spoke the death of San Angelo and Moctezuma in the city of Cordoba. Her eyes widened. Then the story is true. I've heard many versions of the story, Mayor Bosquinha. One tale has it that the devil possessed San Angelo on his deathbed, so he cried out for the unspeakable rites of the pagan Hablador de los Muertos. Bosquinha smiled. That is something like the tale that is whispered. Dom Cristán says it's nonsense, of course. It happens that San Angelo, back before he was sainted, attended my speaking for a woman that he knew. The fungus in his blood was already killing him. He came to me and said, "Andrew, they're already telling the most terrible lies about me, saying that I've done miracles and should be sainted. You must help me. You must tell the truth at my death." But the miracles have been certified, and he was canonized only 90 years after his death. Yes, well, that's partly my fault. When I spoke his death, I attested several of the miracles myself. Now she laughed aloud. A speaker for the dead believing in miracles? Look at your cathedral hill. How many of those buildings are for the priests, and how many are for the school? Bosquinha understood at once and glared at him. The Filhos da Menchi de Cristo are obedient to the bishop, except that they preserve and teach all knowledge, whether the bishop approves of it or not. San Angelo may have allowed you to meddle in affairs of the church. I assure you that Bishop Peregrino will not. I've come to speak a simple death, and I'll abide by the law. I think you'll find I do less harm than you expect, and perhaps more good. If you've come to speak Pipo's death, Speaker Pelos Mortos, then you will do nothing but harm. Leave the piggies behind the wall. If I had my way, no human being would pass through that fence again. I hope there's a room I can rent. We're an unchanging town here, Speaker. Everyone has a house here, and there's nowhere else to go. Why would anyone maintain an inn? We can only offer you one of the small plastic dwellings the first colonists put up. It's small, but it has all the amenities. Since I don't need many amenities or much space, I'm sure it will be fine. And I look forward to meeting Dom Cristão. Where the followers of San Angelo are, the truth has friends. Bosquinha sniffed and started the car again. As Ender intended, her preconceived notions of a speaker for the dead were now shattered. To think he had actually known San Angelo and admired the Filhos, it was not what Bishop Peregrino had led them to expect. The room was only thinly furnished, and if Ender had owned much, he would have had trouble finding anywhere to put it. As always before, however, he was able to unpack from interstellar flight in only a few minutes. Only the bundled cocoon of the Hive Queen remained in his bag. He had long since given up feeling odd about the incongruity of stowing the future of a magnificent race in a duffel under his bed. "Maybe this will be the place," he murmured. The cocoon felt cool, almost cold, even through the towels it was wrapped in.
"It is the place."
It was unnerving to have her so certain of it. There was no hint of pleading or impatience or any of the other feelings she had given him in the past, desiring to emerge. Just absolute certainty. "I wish we could decide just like that," he said. "It might be the place, but it all depends on whether the piggies can cope with having you here."
"The question is whether they can cope with you humans without us."
"It takes time. Give me a few months here."
"Take all the time you need. We're in no hurry now."
"Who is it that you found? I thought you told me you couldn't communicate with anybody but me."
"The part of our mind that holds our thought. What you call the philotic impulse. The power of the ansibles. It is very cold and hard to find in human beings. But this one, the one we found here, one of many that we'll find here, his philotic impulse is much stronger, much clearer, easier to find. He hears us more easily. And so forgive us, dear friend, forgive us if we leave the hard work of talking to your mind and go back to him and talk to him, because he doesn't make us search so hard to make words and pictures
that are clear enough for your analytical mind, because we feel him like sunshine, like the warmth of sunshine on his face, on our face, and the feel of cool water deep in our abdomen, and movement as gentle and thorough as soft wind, which we haven't felt for 3,000 years. Forgive us, we'll be with him until you wake us, until you take us out to dwell here, because you will do it. You will find out in your own way, in your own time, that this is the place here. It is. This is home. And then he lost the thread of her thought, felt it seep away like a dream that is forgotten upon waking, even as you try to remember it and keep it alive. Ender wasn't sure what the Hive Queen had found, but whatever it was, he would have to deal with the reality of Starway's code, the Catholic Church, young xenologists who might not even let him meet the piggies, a xenobiologist who had changed her mind about inviting him here, and something more. Perhaps the most difficult thing of all, that if the Hive Queen stayed here, he would have to stay here. I've been disconnected from humanity for so many years, he thought, coming in to meddle and pry and hurt and heal, then going away again, myself untouched. How will I ever become a part of this place, if this is where I'll stay? The only things I've ever been a part of were an army of little boys in the battle school and Valentine, and both are gone now, both part of the past. What, wallowing in loneliness? Asked Jane. I can hear your heart rate falling and your breathing getting heavy. In a moment you'll either be asleep, dead, or lachrymose. I'm much more complex than that, said Ender cheerfully. Anticipated self-pity is what I'm feeling about pains that haven't even arrived. Very good, Ender. Get an early start. That way you can wallow so much longer. The terminal came alive, showing Jane as a piggy in a chorus line of leggy women, high-kicking with exuberance. Get a little exercise. You'll feel so much better. After all, you've unpacked. What are you waiting for? I don't even know where I am, Jane. They really don't keep a map of the city, Jane explained. Everybody knows where everything is. But they do have a map of the sewer system, divided into boroughs. I can extrapolate where all the buildings are. Show me, then. A three-dimensional model of the town appeared over the terminal. Ender might not be particularly welcome there, and his room might be sparse, but they had shown courtesy in the terminal they provided for him. It wasn't a standard home installation, but rather an elaborate simulator. It was able to project hollows into a space 16 times larger than most terminals, with a resolution 4 times greater. The illusion was so real that Ender felt for a vertiginous moment that he was Gulliver, leaning over a Lilliput that had not yet come to fear him, that did not yet recognize his power to destroy. The names of the different boroughs hung in the air over each sewer district. You're here, said Jane. Villa Velha, the old town. Praza is just through the block from you. That's where public meetings are held. Do you have any map of the piggy lands? The village map slid rapidly toward Ender, the near features disappearing as new ones came into view on the far side. It was as if he were flying over it, like a witch, he thought. The boundary of the town was marked by a fence. That barrier is the only thing standing between us and the piggies, mused Ender. It generates an electric field that stimulates any pain-sensitive nerves that come within it, said Jane. Just touching it makes all your wetware go screwy. It makes you feel as though somebody were cutting off your fingers with a file. Pleasant thought. Are we in a concentration camp? Or a zoo? It all depends on how you look at it, said Jane. It's the human side of the fence that's connected to the rest of the universe, and the piggy side that's trapped on its home world. The difference is that they don't know what they're missing. I know, said Jane. It's the most charming thing about humans. You are all so sure that the lesser animals are bleeding with envy because they didn't have the good fortune to be born Homo sapiens. Beyond the fence was a hillside, and along the top of the hill, a thick forest began. The xenologists have never gone deep into piggy lands. The piggy community that they deal with is less than a kilometer inside this wood. The piggies live in a log house, all the males together. We don't know about any other settlements, except that the satellites have been able to confirm that every forest like this one carries just about all the population that a hunter-gatherer culture can sustain. They hunt,
Mostly they gather. Where did Pippo and Libo die? Jane brightened a patch of grassy ground on the hillside leading up to the trees. A large tree grew in isolation nearby, with two smaller ones not far off. Those trees, said Ender. I don't remember any being so close in the hollows I saw in Trondheim. It's been 22 years. The big one is the tree the piggies planted in the corpse of the rebel called Rooter, who was executed before Pippo was murdered. The other two are more recent piggy executions. I wish I knew why they plant trees for piggies and not for humans. The trees are sacred, said Jane. Pippo recorded that many of the trees in the forest are named. Libo speculated that they might be named for the dead. And humans simply aren't part of the pattern of tree worship. Well, that's likely enough. Except that I found that rituals and myths don't come from nowhere. There's usually some reason for it that's tied to the survival of the community. Andrew Wiggin, anthropologist. The proper study of mankind is man. Go study some men then, Ender. Novinia's family, for instance. By the way, the computer network has officially been barred from showing you where anybody lives. Ender grinned. Oh, so, Boskinia isn't as friendly as she seems. If you have to ask where people live, they'll know where you're going. If they don't want you to go there, no one will know where they live. You can override the restriction, can't you? I already have. A light was blinking near the fence line, behind the observatory hill. It was as isolated a spot as was possible to find in Milagri. Few other houses had been built where the fence would be visible all the time. Ender wondered whether Novinia had chosen to live there to be near the fence or to be far from neighbors. Perhaps it had been Markau's choice. The nearest burrow was Villa Atras, and then the burrow called Asfabricas stretched down to the river. As the name implied, it consisted mostly of small factories that worked the metals and plastics and processed the foods and fibers that Milagre used. A nice, tight, self-contained economy. And Novinia had chosen to live back behind everything, out of sight, invisible. It was Novinia who chose it, too. Ender was sure of that now. Wasn't it the pattern of her life? She had never belonged to Milagre. It was no accident that all three calls for a speaker had come from her and her children. The very act of calling a speaker was defiant, a sign that they did not think they belonged among the devout Catholics of Lusitania. Still, said Ender, I have to ask someone to lead me there. I shouldn't let them know right away that they can't hide any of their information from me. The map disappeared, and Jane's face appeared above the terminal. She had neglected to adjust for the greater size of this terminal so that her head was many times human size. She was quite imposing, and her simulation was accurate right down to the pores on her face. Actually, Andrew, it's me they can't hide anything from. Ender sighed. You have a vested interest in this, Jane. I know, she winked. But you don't. Are you telling me you don't trust me? You reek of impartiality and a sense of justice, but I'm human enough to want preferential treatment, Andrew. Will you promise me one thing at least? Anything, my corpuscular friend. When you decide to hide something from me, will you at least tell me that you aren't going to tell me? This is getting way too deep for little old me. She was a caricature of an over-feminine woman. Nothing is too deep for you, Jane. Do us both a favor. Don't cut me off at the knees. While you're off with the Hibera family, is there anything you'd like me to be doing? Yes. Find every way in which the Hiberas are significantly different from the rest of the people of Lusitania, and any points of conflict between them and the authorities. You speak, and I obey. She started to do her genie disappearing act. You maneuvered me here, Jane. Why are you trying to unnerve me? I'm not, and I didn't. I have a shortage of friends in this town. You can trust me with your life. It isn't my life I'm worried about. The plaza was filled with children playing football. Most of them were stunting, showing how long they could keep the ball in the air using only their feet and heads. Two of them, though, had a vicious duel going. The boy would kick the ball as hard as he could toward the girl, who stood not 3 meters away. She would stand and take the impact of the ball, not flinching no matter how hard it struck her. Then she would kick the ball back at him, and he would try not to flinch. A little girl was tending the ball, fetching it each time it rebounded from a victim. Ender tried asking some of the boys if they knew where the Hibera family's house was. Their answer was invariably a shrug. When he persisted, some of them began moving away, and soon most of the children had retreated from the praza. Ender wondered what the bishop had told everybody about speakers. The duel, however, continued unabated, and now that the praza was not so crowded, Ender saw that another child was involved, a boy of about 12. He was not extraordinary from behind, but as Ender moved toward the middle of the praza, he could see that there was something wrong with the boy's eyes. It took a moment, but then he understood. The boy had artificial eyes. Both looked shiny and metallic, but Ender knew how they worked. Only one eye was used for sight, but it took four separate visual scans and then separated the signals to feed simulated binocular vision to the brain. The other eye contained the power supply, the computer control, and the external interface. When he wanted to, he could record short sequences of vision in a limited photo memory, probably less than a trillion bits. The duelists were using him as their judge. If they disputed a point, he could replay the scene in slow motion and tell them what had happened. The ball went straight for the boy's crotch. He winced elaborately, but the girl was not impressed.
"He swiveled away. I saw his hips move."
"Did not. You hurt me. I didn't dodge at all."
"Revea, revea."
They had been speaking Stark, but the girl now switched into Portuguese. The boy with metal eyes showed no expression, but raised a hand to silence them.
"Mudou,"
he said with finality.
"He moved,"
Ender translated.
"Sabia, I knew it. You liar, Olhado."
The boy with metal eyes looked at him with disdain.
"I never lie. I'll send you a dump of the scene if you want. In fact, I think I'll post it on the net so everybody can watch you dodge and then lie about it.
Mentiroso.
Fio de puta. Fore bode."
Ender was pretty sure what the epithets meant, but the boy with metal eyes took it calmly.
"Da,"
said the girl.
"Dame."
"Give it here." The boy furiously took off his ring and threw it on the ground at her feet.
"Viada,"
he said in a hoarse whisper. Then he took off running.
"Poltron,"
shouted the girl after him. "Coward."
"Calm,"
shouted the boy, not even looking over his shoulder. It was not the girl he was shouting at this time. She turned at once to look at the boy with metal eyes, who stiffened at the name. Almost at once, the girl looked at the ground. The little one, who had been doing the ball fetching, walked to the boy with metal eyes and whispered something. He looked up, noticing Ender for the first time. The older girl was apologizing.
"Desculpa, Olhado. Nyao kiriaki. Nyao ha problema, Michi."
He did not look at her. The girl started to go on, but then she too noticed Ender and fell silent.
"Por qué está olhándonos?"
asked the boy. "Why are you looking at us?" Ender answered with a question.
"Voce e arbitro."
"You're the arbiter here?" The word could mean umpire, but it could also mean magistrate.
"De vez en cuando."
"Sometimes." Ender switched to Stark. He wasn't sure he knew how to say anything complex in Portuguese. "Then tell me, arbiter, is it fair to leave a stranger to find his way around without help?"
"Stranger? You mean Utlaning, Framling, or Raman?"
"No, I think I mean infidel."
"Oh, Signore di Screnci, you're an unbeliever?"
"Só descrevo no incrível." "I only disbelieve the unbelievable." The boy grinned. "Where do you want to go, speaker?"
"The house of the Hibera family."
The little girl edged closer to the boy with metal eyes.
"Which Hibera family?"
"The widow Ivanova."
"I think I can find it," said the boy.
"Everybody in town can find it," said Ender. "The point is, will you take me there?"
"Why do you want to go there?"
"I ask people questions and try to find out true stories."
"Nobody at the Hibera house knows any true stories."
"I'd settle for lies."
"Come on, then."
He started toward the low-mown grass of the main road. The little girl was whispering in his ear. He stopped and turned to Ender, who was following close behind.
"Quara wants to know. What's your name?"
"Andrew. Andrew Wigan."
"She's Quara."
"And you?"
"Everybody calls me Olhado, because of my eyes."
He picked up the little girl and put her on his shoulders. "But my real name's Lauro.
Lauro Sulimao.
Hibera." He grinned, then turned around and strode off. Ender followed.
"Hibera, of course."
Jane had been listening, too, and spoke from the jewel in his ear.
Lauro Sulemao Ribeira is Novinha's fourth child. He lost his eyes in a laser accident. He's 12 years old. Oh, and I found one difference between the Ribeira family and the rest of the town. The Ribeiras are willing to defy the bishop and lead you where you want to go. I noticed something too, Jane, he answered silently. This boy enjoyed deceiving me and then enjoyed even more letting me see how I'd been fooled. I just hope you don't take lessons from him.
Nero sat on the hillside. The shade of the trees made him invisible to anyone who might be watching from Milagre, but he could see much of the town from here, certainly the cathedral and the monastery on the highest hill, and then the observatory on the next hill to the north. And under the observatory, in a depression in the hillside, the house where he lived, not very far from the fence.
Miru,
whispered Leaf Eater.
Are you a tree?
It was a translation from the Pequeninos idiom. Sometimes they meditated, holding themselves motionless for hours. They called this being a tree. More like a blade of grass, Miro answered. Leaf Eater giggled in the high, wheezy way he had. It never sounded natural. The Pequeninos had learned laughter by rote, as if it were simply another word in stark. It didn't arise out of amusement, or at least Miro didn't think it did.
Is it going to rain? Asked Miro.
To a piggy, this meant, are you interrupting me for my own sake or for yours?
It rained fire today, said Leaf Eater. Out in the prairie.
Yes, we have a visitor from another world.
Is it the speaker?
Miro didn't answer.
You must bring him to see us.
Miro didn't answer.
I root my face in the ground for you, Miro. My limbs are lumber for your house.
Miro hated it when they begged for something. It was as if they thought of him as someone particularly wise or strong, a parent from whom favors must be wheedled. Well, if they felt that way, it was his own fault, his and Libo's, playing God out here among the piggies. I promised, didn't I, Leaf Eater?
When?
It'll take time. I have to find out whether he can be trusted. Leaf Eater looked baffled. Miro had tried to explain that not all humans knew each other, and some weren't nice, but they never seemed to understand.
As soon as I can, Miro said.
Suddenly, Leaf Eater began to rock back and forth on the ground, shifting his hips from side to side as if he were trying to relieve an itch in his anus. Libo had speculated once that this was what performed the same function that laughter did for humans.
Talk to me in piddle geese, wheezed Leaf Eater.
Leaf Eater always seemed to be greatly amused that Miro and the other Xenadors spoke two languages interchangeably. This despite the fact that at least four different piggy languages had been recorded or at least hinted at over the years, all spoken by the same tribe of piggies. But if he wanted to hear Portuguese, he'd get Portuguese.
Vai comer folhas.
Go eat leaves. Leaf Eater looked puzzled.
Why is that clever?
Because that's your name.
Come folhas.
Leaf Eater pulled a large insect out of his nostril and flipped it away, buzzing.
Don't be crude, he said.
Then he walked away. Miro watched him go. Leaf Eater was always so difficult. Miro much preferred the company of the piggy called Human. Even though Human was smarter, and Miro had to watch himself more carefully with him, at least he didn't seem hostile the way Leaf Eater often did. With the piggy out of sight, Miro turned back toward the city. Somebody was moving down the path along the face of the hill toward his house. The one in front was very tall. No, it was Olhado with Quara on his shoulders. Quara was much too old for that. Miro worried about her. She seemed not to be coming out of the shock of father's death. Miro felt a moment's bitterness. And to think he and Ella had expected father's death would solve all their problems. Then he stood up and tried to get a better view of the man behind Olhado and Quara. No one he'd seen before.
The speaker.
Already? He couldn't have been in town for more than an hour, and he was already going to the house.
That's great. All I need is for Mother to find out that I was the one who called him here. Somehow I thought that a speaker for the dead would be discreet about it, not just come straight home to the person who called. What a fool. Bad enough that he's coming years before I expected a speaker to get here. Quinn's bound to report this to the bishop, even if nobody else does. Now I'm going to have to deal with Mother, and probably the whole city. Miro moved back into the trees and jogged along a path that led, eventually, to the gate back into the city.
Chapter 7. The Hibera House.
Miro, this time you should have been there, because even though I have a better memory for dialogue than you, I sure don't know what this means. You saw the new piggy, the one they call human? I thought I saw you talking to him for a minute before you took off for the questionable activity. Mandachuva told me they named him human because he was very smart, as a child. Okay, it's very flattering that smart and human are linked in their minds, or perhaps patronizing that they think will be flattered by that. But that's not what matters. Mandachuva then said he could already talk when he started walking around by himself. And he made a gesture with his hand about 10 centimeters off of the ground. To me, it looked like he was telling how tall human was when he learned how to talk and walk. 10 centimeters. But I could be completely wrong. You should have been there to see for yourself. If I'm right, and that's what Mandachuva meant, then for the first time we have an idea of piggy childhood. If they actually start walking at 10 centimeters in height, and talking no less, then they must have less development time during gestation than humans, and do a lot more developing after they're born. But now it gets absolutely crazy, even by your standards. He then leaned in close and told me, as if he weren't supposed to, who human's father was. Your grandfather Pipo knew human's father. His tree is near your gate. Is he kidding? Reuter died 24 years ago, didn't he? Okay, maybe this is just a religious thing, sort of adopt a tree or something, but the way Mandachuva was so secretive about it, I kept thinking it's somehow true. Is it possible that they have a 24-year gestation period? Or maybe it took a couple of decades for human to develop from a 10-centimeter toddler into the fine specimen of piggyhood we now see. Or maybe Reuter's sperm was saved in a jar somewhere. But this matters. This is the first time a piggy personally known to human observers has ever been named as a father. And Reuter, no less, the very one that got murdered. In other words, the male with the lowest prestige, an executed criminal even, has been named as a father. That means that our males aren't cast-off bachelors at all, even though some of them are so old they knew Pipo. They are potential fathers. What's more, if human was so remarkably smart, then why was he dumped here, if this is really a group of miserable bachelors? I think we've had it wrong for quite a while. This isn't a low-prestige group of bachelors. This is a high-prestige group of juveniles, and some of them are really going to amount to something. So, when you told me you felt sorry for me because you got to go out on the questionable activity and I had to stay home and work up some official fabrications for the Ansible report, you were full of unpleasant excretions. If you get home after I'm asleep, wake me up for a kiss, okay? I earned it today.
Memo from Wanda Figuera Mukumbi to Miro Hibera Van Hesse. Retrieved from Lusitanian files by congressional order and introduced as evidence in the trial in absentia of the xenologers of Lusitania on charges of treason and malfeasance.
There was no construction industry in Lusitania. When a couple got married, their friends and family built them a house. The Hibera House expressed the history of the family. At the front, the old part of the house was made of plastic sheets rooted to a concrete foundation. Rooms had been built on as the family grew, each addition abutting the one before, so that 5 distinct one-story structures fronted the hillside. The later ones were all brick, decently plumbed, roofed with tile, but with no attempt whatever at aesthetic appeal. The family had built exactly what was needed, and nothing more. It was not poverty, Ender knew. There was no poverty in a community where the economy was completely controlled. The lack of decoration, of individuality, showed the family's contempt for their own house. To Ender, this bespoke contempt for themselves as well. Certainly Olhado and Quara showed none of the relaxation, the letting down that most people feel when they come home. If anything, they grew warier, less jaunty. The house might have been a subtle source of gravity, making them heavier the nearer they approached. Olhado and Quara went right in. Ander waited at the door for someone to invite him to enter. Olhado left the door ajar, but walked on out of the room without speaking to him. Ander could see Quara sitting on a bed in the front room, leaning against a bare wall. There was nothing whatsoever on any of the walls. They were stark white. Quara's face matched the blankness of the walls. Though her eyes regarded Ender unwaveringly, she showed no sign of recognizing that he was there. Certainly she did nothing to indicate he might come in. There was a disease in this house. Ender tried to understand what it was in Novinia's character that he had missed before that would let her live in a place like this. Had Pippo's death so long before emptied Novinia's heart as thoroughly as this? "Is your mother home?" Ender asked. Quara said nothing. "Oh," he said, "excuse me, I thought you were a little girl, but I see now that you're a statue." She showed no sign of hearing him, so much for trying to jolly her out of her somberness. Shoes slapped rapidly against the concrete floor. A little boy ran into the room, stopped in the middle, and whirled to face the doorway where Ender stood. He couldn't be more than a year younger than Quara, 6 or 7 years old, probably. Unlike Quara, his face showed plenty of understanding, along with a feral hunger. "Is your mother home?" asked Ender. The boy bent over and carefully rolled up his pant leg. He had taped a long kitchen knife to his leg. Slowly he untaped it. Then, holding it in front of him with both hands, he aimed himself at Ender and launched himself full speed. Ender noted that the knife was well aimed at his crotch. The boy was not subtle in his approach to strangers. A moment later, Ender had the boy tucked under his arm and the knife jammed into the ceiling. The boy was kicking and screaming. Ender had to use both hands to control his limbs. The boy ended up dangling in front of him by his hands and feet, for all the world like a calf roped for branding. Ender looked steadily at Quara. "If you don't go right now and get whoever's in charge in this house, I'm going to take this animal home and serve it for supper." Quara thought about this for a moment, then got up and ran out of the room. A moment later, a tired-looking girl with tousled hair and sleepy eyes came into the front room. "Desculpe, por favor," she murmured. "O menino nyan, sereste belesu desde a morte du pai." Then she seemed suddenly to come awake. "Oh, senor, e o falante pelos mortos. You're the speaker for the dead." "Sue," answered Ender. "I am." "Noun, aqui," she said. "Oh, no, I'm sorry. Do you speak Portuguese? Of course you do. You just answered me. Oh, please, not here, not now. Go away." "Fine," said Ender. "Should I keep the boy or the knife?" He glanced up at the ceiling. Her gaze followed his. "Oh, no, I'm sorry. We looked for it all day yesterday. We knew he had it, but we didn't know where." "It was taped to his leg." "It wasn't yesterday. We always look there. Please let go of him."
"Are you sure? I think he's been sharpening his teeth."
"Grego," she said to the boy, "it's wrong to poke at people with the knife."
Grego growled in his throat.
"His father dying, you see."
"They were that close?" A look of bitter amusement passed across her face. "Hardly. He's always been a thief, Grego has, ever since he was old enough to hold something and walk at the same time. But this thing for hurting people, that's new. Please let him down."
"No," said Ender. Her eyes narrowed and she looked defiant.
"Are you kidnapping him? To take him where? For what ransom?"
"Perhaps you don't understand," said Ender. "He assaulted me. You've offered me no guarantee that he won't do it again. You've made no provision for disciplining him when I set him down."
As he had hoped, fury came into her eyes.
"Who do you think you are? This is his house, not yours."
"Actually," Ender said, "I've just had a rather long walk from the Praza to your house," and Olhado set a brisk pace. "I'd like to sit down." She nodded toward a chair. Grego wriggled and twisted against Ender's grip. Ender lifted him high enough that their faces weren't too far apart.
"You know, Grego, if you actually break free, you will certainly fall on your head on a concrete floor. If there were a carpet, I'd give you an even chance of staying conscious, but there isn't. And frankly, I wouldn't mind hearing the sound of your head smacking against cement."
"He doesn't really understand Stark that well," said the girl.
Ender knew that Grego understood just fine.
He also saw motion at the edges of the room. Olliardo had come back and stood in the doorway leading to the kitchen. Quara was beside him. Ender smiled cheerfully at them, then stepped to the chair the girl had indicated. In the process, he swung Grego up into the air, letting go of his hands and feet in such a way that he spun madly for a moment, shooting out his arms and legs in panic, squealing in fear at the pain that would certainly come when he hit the floor. Ender smoothly slid onto the chair and caught the boy on his lap, instantly pinioning his arms. Grego managed to smack his heels into Ender's shins, but since the boy wasn't wearing shoes, it was an ineffective maneuver. In a moment, Ender had him completely helpless again. "It feels very good to be sitting down," Ender said. "Thank you for your hospitality. My name is Andrew Wigan. I've met Olliardo and Quara, and obviously Grego and I are good friends." The older girl wiped her hand on her apron as if she planned to offer it to him to shake, but she did not offer it. "My name is Ella Hibera. Ella is short for Eleonora. A pleasure to meet you. I see you're busy preparing supper." "Yes, very busy. I think you should come back tomorrow." "Oh, go right ahead. I don't mind waiting." Another boy, older than Olliardo but younger than Ella, shoved his way into the room. "Didn't you hear my sister? You aren't wanted here." "You show me too much kindness," Ender said. "But I came to see your mother, and I'll wait here until she comes home from work." The mention of their mother silenced them. "I assume she's at work. If she were here, I would expect these exciting events would have flushed her out into the open." Olliardo smiled a bit at that, but the older boy darkened, and Ella got a nasty, painful expression on her face. "Why do you want to see her?" asked Ella. "Actually, I want to see all of you." He smiled at the older boy. "You must be Estevan Rey Hibera, named for St. Stephen the Martyr, who saw Jesus sitting at the right hand of God. What do you know of such things, atheist?" "As I recall, St. Paul stood by and held the coats of the men who were stoning him. Apparently, he wasn't a believer at the time. In fact, I think he was regarded as the most terrible enemy of the church. And yet, he later repented, didn't he? So I suggest you think of me not as the enemy of God, but as an apostle who has not yet been stopped on the road to Damascus." Ender smiled. The boy stared at him, tight-lipped. "You're no St. Paul." "On the contrary," said Ender. "I'm the apostle to the piggies." "You'll never see them. Miro will never let you." "Maybe I will," said a voice from the door. The others turned at once to watch him walk in. Miro was young, surely not yet 20, but his face and bearing carried the weight of responsibility and suffering far beyond his years. Ender saw how all of them made space for him. It was not that they backed away from him the way they might retreat from someone they feared. Rather, they oriented themselves to him, walking in parabolas around him, as if he were the center of gravity in the room, and everything else was moved by the force of his presence. Miro walked to the center of the room and faced Ender. He looked, however, at Ender's prisoner. "Let him go," said Miro. There was ice in his voice. Ella touched him softly on the arm. "Grego tried to stab him, Miro." But her voice also said, "Be calm. It's all right. Grego's in no danger, and this man is not our enemy." Ender heard all this. So it seemed did Miro. "Grego," said Miro, "I told you that someday you'd take on somebody who wasn't afraid of you." Grego, seeing an ally suddenly turn to an enemy, began to cry, "He's killing me! He's killing me!" Miro looked coldly at Ender. Ella might trust the speaker for the dead, but Miro didn't, not yet. "I am hurting him," said Ender. He had found that the best way to earn trust was to tell the truth. "Every time he struggles to get free, it causes him quite a bit of discomfort, and he hasn't stopped struggling yet." Ender met Miro's gaze steadily, and Miro understood his unspoken request. He did not insist on Grego's release. "I can't get you out of this one, Greguinho."
"You're going to let him do this?" asked Estevan.
Miro gestured toward Estevan and spoke apologetically to Ender. "Everyone calls him King." The nickname, spelled Q-U-I-M, was pronounced like the word King in Stark. It began because his middle name is Rey, but now it's because he thinks he rules by divine right. "Bastard," said King. He stalked out of the room. At the same time, the others settled in for conversation. Miro had decided to accept the stranger, at least temporarily. Therefore, they could let down their guard a little. Olhado sat down on the floor. Quara returned to her previous perch on the bed. Ella leaned back against the wall. Miro pulled up another chair and sat facing Ender. "Why did you come to this house?" asked Miro. Ender saw from the way he asked that he, like Ella, had not told anyone that he had summoned a speaker, so neither of them knew that the other expected him, and, in fact, they almost undoubtedly had not expected him to come so soon. "To see your mother," Ender said. Miro's relief was almost palpable, though he made no obvious gesture. "She's at work," he said. "She works late. She's trying to develop a strain of potato that can compete with the grass here. Like the amaranth?" He grinned. "You already heard about that. No, we don't want it to be as good a competitor as that. But the diet here is limited, and potatoes would be a nice addition. Besides, amaranth doesn't ferment into a very good beverage. The miners and farmers have already created a mythology of vodka that makes it the queen of distilled intoxicants." Miro's smile came to this house like sunlight through a crevice in a cave. Ender could feel the loosening of tensions. Quara wiggled her leg back and forth like an ordinary little girl. Olhado had a stupidly happy expression on his face, his eyes half closed, so that the metallic sheen was not so monstrously obvious. Ella's smile was broader than Miro's good humor should have earned. Even Grego had relaxed, had stopped straining against Ender's grip. Then a sudden warmth on Ender's lap told him that Grego, at least, was far from surrender. Ender had trained himself not to respond reflexively to an enemy's actions until he had consciously decided to let his reflexes rule. So Grego's flood of urine did not cause him to so much as flinch. He knew what Grego had been expecting, a shout of anger, and Ender flinging him away, casting him from his lap in disgust. Then Grego would be free. It would be a triumph. Ender yielded him no victory. Ella, however, apparently knew the expressions of Grego's face. Her eyes went wide, and then she took an angry step toward the boy. "Grego, you impossible little..." But Ender winked at her and smiled, freezing her in place. "Grego has given me a little gift. It's the only thing he has to give me, and he made it himself, so it means all the more. I like him so much that I think I'll never let him go." Grego snarled and struggled again madly to break free. "Why are you doing this?" said Ella. "He's expecting Grego to act like a human being," said Miro. "It needs doing, and nobody else has bothered to try." "I've tried," said Ella. Olhado spoke up from his place on the floor. "Ella's the only one here who keeps us civilized." King shouted from the other room, "Don't you tell that bastard anything about our family!" Ender nodded gravely as if King had offered a brilliant intellectual proposition. Miro chuckled, and Ella rolled her eyes and sat down on the bed beside Quara. "We're not a very happy home," said Miro. "I understand," said Ender, "with your father so recently dead." Miro smiled sardonically. Olhado spoke up again. "With father so recently alive, you mean?" Ella and Miro were in obvious agreement with this sentiment, but King shouted again, "Don't tell him anything!" "Did he hurt you?" Ender asked quietly. He did not move, even though Grego's urine was getting cold and rank. Ella answered, "He didn't hit us, if that's what you mean." But for Miro, things had gone too far. "King's right," said Miro. "It's nobody's business but ours." "No," said Ella, "it's his business." "How is it his business?" asked Miro. "Because he's here to speak father's death," said Ella. "Father's death?" said Olhado. "Chupa pedras. Father only died 3 weeks ago." "I was already on my way to speak another death," said Ender. "But someone did call for a speaker for your father's death, and so I'll speak for him." "Against him," said Ella. "For him," said Ender. "I brought you here to tell the truth," she said bitterly, "and all the truth about father is against him." Silence pressed to the corners of the room, holding them all still, until King walked slowly through the doorway. He looked only at Ella.
"You called him," he said softly. "You."
"To tell the truth," she answered. His accusation obviously stung her. He did not have to say how she had betrayed her family and her church to bring this infidel to lay bare what had been so long concealed. "Everybody in Milagre is so kind and understanding," she said.
Our teachers overlook little things like Grego's thievery and Quara's silence. Never mind that she hasn't said a word in school, ever. Everybody pretends that we're just ordinary children, the grandchildren of Os Venerados. And so brilliant, aren't we? With a Zenador and both biologistas in the family. Such prestige! They just look the other way when father gets himself raging drunk and comes home and beats mother until she can't walk. Shut up! Shouted King.
Ella, said Miro.
And you, Miro. Father shouting at you, saying terrible things until you run out of the house. You run, stumbling because you can hardly see. You have no right to tell him, said King.
Olliardo leapt to his feet and stood in the middle of the room, turned around to look at them all with his unhuman eyes.
Why do you still want to hide it? He asked softly.
What's it to you? Asked King. He never did anything to you. You just turned off your eyes and sat there with the headphones on, listening to Batuki or Bach or something.
Turn off my eyes, said Olliardo. I never turned off my eyes.
He whirled and walked to the terminal, which was in the corner of the room farthest from the front door. In a few quick movements, he had the terminal on, then picked up an interface cable and jammed it in the socket of his right eye. It was only a simple computer link-up, but to Ender, it brought back a hideous memory of the eye of a giant, torn open and oozing, as Ender bored deep, penetrated to the brain, and sent it toppling backward to its death. He froze up for a moment before he remembered that his memory was not real. It was of a computer game he had played in the battle school 3,000 years ago. But to him, a mere 25 years, not such a great distance that the memory had lost its power. It was his memories and dreams of the giant's death that the buggers had taken out of his mind and turned into the signal they left for him. Eventually, it had led him to the Hive Queen's cocoon. It was Jane's voice that brought him back to the present moment. She whispered from the jewel, "If it's all the same to you, while he's got that eye linked up, I'm going to get a dump of everything else he's got stored away in there." Then a scene began in the air over the terminal. It was not holographic. Instead, the image was like a bas-relief, as it would have appeared to a single observer. It was this very room, seen from the spot on the floor where a moment ago Olliardo had been sitting. Apparently it was his regular spot. In the middle of the floor stood a large man, strong and violent, flinging his arms about as he shouted abuse at Miro, who stood quietly, his head bent, regarding his father without any sign of anger. There was no sound. It was a visual image only.
"Have you forgotten?" whispered Olliardo. "Have you forgotten what it was like?"
In the scene on the terminal, Miro finally turned and left, Marcaum following him to the door, shouting after him. Then he turned back into the room and stood there, panting like an animal exhausted from the chase. In the picture, Grego ran to his father and clung to his leg, shouting out the door, his face making it plain that he was echoing his father's cruel words to Miro. Marcaum pried the child from his leg and walked with determined purpose into the back room. "There's no sound," said Olliardo, "but you can hear it, can't you?" Ender felt Grego's body trembling on his lap. "There it is. A blow, a crash. She's falling to the floor. Can you feel it in your flesh? The way her body hits the concrete?" "Shut up, Olliardo," said Miro. The computer-generated scene ended.
"I can't believe you saved that," said Ella.
King was weeping, making no effort to hide it.
"I killed him," he said. "I killed him, I killed him, I killed him."
"What are you talking about?" said Miro in exasperation. "He had a rotten disease. It was congenital."
"I prayed for him to die," screamed King.
His face was mottled with passion, tears and mucus and spittle mingling around his lips.
"I prayed to the Virgin, I prayed to Jesus, I prayed to Grandpa and Grandma. I said I'd go to hell for it if only he'd die, and they did it. And now I'll go to hell, and I'm not sorry for it. God forgive me, but I'm glad."
Sobbing, he stumbled back out of the room. A door slammed in the distance. "Well, another certified miracle to the credit of Os Venerados," said Miro. "Sainthood is assured." "Shut up," said Olliardo. "And he's the one who kept telling us that Christ wanted us to forgive the old fart," said Miro. On Ender's lap, Grego now trembled so violently that Ender grew concerned. He realized that Grego was whispering a word. Ella, too, saw Grego's distress and knelt in front of the boy.
He's crying. I've never seen him cry like this.
Papa, papa, papa,
whispered Grego. His trembling had given way to great shudders, almost convulsive in their violence.
Is he afraid of father? Asked Oliado.
His face showed deep concern for Grego. To Ender's relief, all their faces were full of worry. There was love in this family, and not just the solidarity of living under the rule of the same tyrant for all these years.
Papa's gone now, said Miro comfortingly. You don't have to worry now.
Ender shook his head. Miro, he said, didn't you watch Oliado's memory? Little boys don't judge their fathers, they love them. Grego was trying as hard as he could to be just like Marcos Ibera. The rest of you might have been glad to see him gone, but for Grego, it was the end of the world. It had not occurred to any of them. Even now, it was a sickening idea. Ender could see them recoil from it, and yet they knew it was true. Now that Ender had pointed it out, it was obvious. Deus nos perdoa, murmured Ella. God forgive us. The things we've said, whispered Miro. Ella reached out for Grego. He refused to go to her. Instead, he did exactly what Ender expected, what he had prepared for. Grego turned in Ender's relaxed grip, flung his arms around the neck of the speaker of the dead, and wept bitterly, hysterically. Ender spoke gently to the others who watched helplessly. How could he show his grief to you when he thought you hated him?
We never hated Grego, said Oliado.
I should have known, said Miro. I knew he was suffering the worst pain of any of us, but it never occurred to me.
Don't blame yourself, said Ender.
It's the kind of thing that only a stranger can see. He heard Jane whispering in his ear.
You never cease to amaze me, Andrew, the way you turn people into plasma.
Ender couldn't answer her, and she wouldn't believe him anyway. He hadn't planned this. He had played it by ear. How could he have guessed that Oliado would have a recording of Marcaun's viciousness to his family? His only real insight was with Grego, and even that was instinctive, a sense that Grego was desperately hungry for someone to have authority over him, for someone to act like a father to him. Since his own father had been cruel, Grego would believe only cruelty as a proof of love and strength. Now his tears washed Ender's neck as hotly as a moment before his urine had soaked Ender's thighs. He had guessed what Grego would do, but Quara managed to take him by surprise. As the others watched Grego's weeping in silence, she got off the bed and walked directly to Ender. Her eyes were narrow and angry.
You stink, she said firmly.
Then she marched out of the room toward the back of the house. Miro barely suppressed his laughter, and Ella smiled. Ender raised his eyebrows as if to say, Hey, you win some, you lose some. Oliado seemed to hear his unspoken words. From his chair by the terminal, the metal-eyed boy said softly, You win with her, too. It's the most she's said to anyone outside the family in months.
But I'm not outside the family, Ender said silently. Didn't you notice? I'm in the family now, whether you like it or not, whether I like it or not.
After a while, Grego's sobbing stopped. He was asleep. Ender carried him to his bed. Quara was already asleep on the other side of the small room. Ella helped Ender strip off Grego's urine-soaked pants and put looser underwear on him. Her touch was gentle and deft, and Grego did not waken. Back in the front room, Miro eyed Ender clinically.
Well, Speaker, you have a choice.
My pants will be tight on you and too short in the crotch, but father's would fall right off.
It took Ender a moment to remember. Grego's urine had long since dried.
Don't worry about it, he said.
I can change when I get home.
Mother won't be home for another hour. You came to see her, didn't you?
We can have your pants clean by then.
Your pants, then, said Ender. I'll take my chances with the crotch.
Chapter 8 Donna Ivanova. It means a life of constant deception. You will go out and discover something, something vital, and then when you get back to the station, you'll write up a completely innocuous report, one which mentions nothing that we learned through cultural contamination. You're too young to understand what torture this is.
Father and I began doing this because we couldn't bear to withhold knowledge from the piggies. You will discover, as I have, that it is no less painful to withhold knowledge from your fellow scientists. When you watch them struggle with a question, knowing that you have the information that could easily resolve their dilemma, when you see them come very near the truth and then, for lack of your information, retreat from their correct conclusions and return to error, you would not be human if it didn't cause you great anguish. You must remind yourselves always, it is their law, their choice. They are the ones who built the wall between themselves and the truth, and they would only punish us if we let them know how easily and thoroughly that wall has been breached. And for every Fromling scientist who is longing for the truth, there are 10 petty-minded descabezados, headless ones, who despise knowledge, who never think of an original hypothesis, whose only labor is to prey on the writings of the true scientists in order to catch tiny errors or contradictions or lapses in method. These suckflies will pore over every report you make, and if you were careless even once, they will catch you. That means you can't even mention a piggy whose name is derived from cultural contamination. Cups would tell them that we have taught them rudimentary pottery making. Calendar and Reaper are obvious, and God himself couldn't save us if they learned Arrow's name. Memo from Liberdade Figueira de Medici to Wando Figueira Mukumbi and Miro Hibera Van Hesse, retrieved from Lusitanian files by congressional order and introduced as evidence in the trial in absentia of the Xenologers of Lusitania on charges of treason and malfeasance.
Novinha lingered in the Biologista's station, even though her meaningful work was finished more than an hour ago. The cloned potato plants were all thriving in nutrient solution. Now it would be a matter of making daily observations to see which of her genetic alterations would produce the hardiest plant with the most useful root. If I have nothing to do, why don't I go home? She had no answer for the question. Her children needed her, that was certain. She did them no kindness by leaving early each morning and coming home only after the little ones were asleep. And even now, knowing she should go back, she sat staring at the laboratory, seeing nothing, doing nothing, being nothing. She thought of going home and could not imagine why she felt no joy at the prospect. After all, she reminded herself, Marquin is dead. He died 3 weeks ago. Not a moment too soon. He did all that I ever needed him for, and I did all that he wanted, but all our reasons expired 4 years before he finally rotted away. In all that time, we never shared a moment of love. But I never thought of leaving him. Divorce would have been impossible, but desquite would have been enough to stop the beatings. Even yet, her hip was stiff and sometimes painful from the last time he had thrown her to the concrete floor. What lovely memorabilia you left behind, Cain, my dog of a husband. The pain in her hip flared even as she thought of it. She nodded in satisfaction. It's no more than I deserve, and I'll be sorry when it heals. She stood up and walked, not limping at all, even though the pain was more than enough to make her favor the hip. I'll not coddle myself, not in anything. It's no worse than I deserve. She walked to the door, closed it behind her. The computer turned off the lights as soon as she was gone, except those needed for the various plants in forced photosynthetic phase. She loved her plants, her little beasts, with surprising intensity. Grow, she cried out to them day and night. Grow and thrive. She would grieve for the ones that failed and pinch them dead only when it was plain they had no future. Now, as she walked away from the station, she could still hear their subliminal music, the cries of the infinitesimal cells as they grew and split and formed themselves into ever more elaborate patterns. She was going from light into darkness, from life into death, and the emotional pain grew worse in perfect synchronicity with the inflammation of her joints. As she approached her house from over the hill, she could see the patches of light thrown through the windows and out onto the hill below. Cuara's and Grego's room was dark. She would not have to bear their unbearable accusations. Cuara's in silence, Grego's in sullen and vicious crimes. But there were too many other lights on, including her own room and the front room. Something unusual was going on, and she didn't like unusual things. Oliado sat in the living room, earphones on as usual. Tonight, though, he also had the interface jack attached to his eye. Apparently, he was retrieving old visual memories from the computer, or perhaps dumping out some he had been carrying with him. As so many times before, she wished she could also dump out her visual memories and wipe them clean, replace them with more pleasant ones. Pipo's corpse. That would be one she'd gladly be rid of, to be replaced by some of the golden, glorious days with the three of them together in the Xenador station. And Libo's body, wrapped in its cloth, that sweet flesh held together only by the winding fabric. She would like to have instead other memories of his body, the touch of his lips, the expressiveness of his delicate hands. But the good memories fled, buried too deep under the pain. I stole them all, those good days, and so they were taken back and replaced by what I deserved. Oliado turned to face her, the jack emerging obscenely from his eye. She could not control her shudder, her shame. I'm sorry, she said silently. If you had had another mother, you would doubtless still have your eye. You were born to be the best, the healthiest, the wholest of my children, Lauro. But of course, nothing from my womb could be left intact for long. She said nothing of this, of course, just as Oliado said nothing to her. She turned to go back to her room and find out why the light was on. Mother, said Oliado. He had taken the earphones off and was twisting the jack out of his eye. Yes, we have a visitor, he said. The speaker. She felt herself go cold inside. Not tonight, she screamed silently. But she also knew that she would not want to see him tomorrow either, or the next day, or ever. His pants are clean now, and he's in your room changing back into them. I hope you don't mind. Ella emerged from the kitchen. You're home, she said. I poured some cafezinhos, one for you too. I'll wait outside until he's gone, said Novinha. Ella and Oliado looked at each other. Novinha understood at once that they regarded her as a problem to be solved, that apparently they subscribed to whatever the speaker wanted to do here. Well, I'm a dilemma that's not going to be solved by you. Mother, said Oliado, he's not what the bishop said. He's good. Novinha answered him with her most withering sarcasm. Since when are you an expert on good and evil? Again, Ella and Oliado looked at each other. She knew what they were thinking. How can we explain to her? How can we persuade her? Well, dear children, you can't. I am unpersuadable, as Libo found out every week of his life. He never had the secret from me. It's not my fault he died.